Welcome to Connectify Conversations. My name is Sean Topshi, and I'm the Director of Business Development at Connectify. Our mission is to share the experience, expertise, and insights from gaming industry leaders that comes from years of navigating the complexities and impact of compliance. On this episode, I am joined by special guest.
My name is Arpita McGrath, and I'm the Chief Compliance Officer at Sporttrade.
Thanks for joining us today, and remember to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can also learn more anytime at Connectify.com. That's KINECTIFY.com. Arpita, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really glad to have you on today. You know, I've been following Sporttrade's journey. Really excited to talk to you about it. For those people that don't know you that are listening to the podcast, so do you think you could introduce yourself, kind of your journey into the industry, and then we'll talk about Sporttrade as well?
Absolutely. And I am honored to be here, Sean. Thank you for inviting me on here. I'm excited to be here. A little bit about myself. I'm the Chief Compliance Officer at Sporttrade. And my background actually started in auditing. I was an auditor about 15 years ago at this point at Deloitte, where I did external financial statement auditing with Deloitte for a couple of years. I left there and went to a smaller regional firm, Mercadian, who at this point is at the national level. But with them, I worked with doing ESA AML audits, system validations and tuning and optimizations, and consulting. On the consulting side, it was everything from creating or enhancing their BSA AML written program, building out their customer risk rating models, doing risk-based transaction monitoring models, creating and enhancing their KYC CDD programs, conducting trainings on SAR narrative writing, EDD of high-risk customers, look-back reviews, much more. And the clients that we typically worked with were financial institutions or credit unions that were under regulatory scrutiny and needed help putting out the fires, strengthening their programs to address the items that were either under matters requiring attention, so MRAs, or consent orders. And with that experience, it was really being entrenched in FinCEN, BSA AML guidance, and constantly working with regulators to understand and discuss all the interpretations and applications of BSA AML. And then through that, I had the opportunity to be in the beginning of the cannabis legalization and the BSA AML application for that industry in order for banks to accept and open accounts for marijuana-related businesses. I've been in the startup world now for a while, and currently as the Chief Compliance Officer at Sporttrade, I've had the pleasure and opportunity to develop and launch the AML and the responsible gaming programs, which has gotten us into multiple states to right now. We're in New Jersey and Colorado and growing. And I also work with teams to tackle the compliance and regulatory requirements as we continue to grow and launch in more jurisdictions. In addition to that, I am also on the board for the Association of Certified Anti-Money Laundering Specialists for the Greater Philadelphia chapter. And I am also on the board for my alma mater, Drexel, on the board for their LeBeau College of Business's Accounting Advisory Council.
Holy smokes. I don't know how you handle all of that on your plate, but no, thank you for that introduction. And I mean, you've really had the whole gambit of AML, especially when you talk about consulting and the advisory work you've done. I'm sure that's an incredible asset to Sporttrade. How did we get from, you know, advisory and working with banking and credit unions to jumping into a very different world? Obviously, you've been in the startup space, but Sporttrade, I would say, is a little unlike anything you've worked with before, to be fair.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And honestly, I say it's being at the right place at the right time. So when I left auditing and I decided, you know, I would like to do something a little different, because at Deloitte, I also had the opportunity to be in forensic accounting. As I entered the whole AML world, I really enjoyed it. I liked learning about all the risks and how to mitigate them and monitoring customers. Now, fast forward with building out the whole experience and working in a lot of, I would say, different industries, but really financial institutions, the cannabis world, et cetera. When I had the opportunity for Sport Trade, I saw that as a really fun challenge of being able to take everything that I've done and apply it into, I'd say, kind of still a fresh industry and one that isn't as structured or, you know, highly regulated with BSA AML guidance or as visible as it should be or will be in the future. So it really is right place, right time, and really having that opportunity presented, which I'm thankful to have and now be where I am today.
Yeah, I mean, it really, I think you're right in that, you know, there hasn't been as much visibility to BSA and AML. I mean, not by the industry's choice, really.
Right.
I think there's been a lot of calls from the industry, obviously, but it is an interesting space to be operating right now from a BSA AML requirement standpoint and what requirements actually are. You know, with you sitting in that CCO role, obviously it's not just BSA AML that's under you, right? You have the full gambit of, you know, regulatory requirements from the states, the RG things that come with it, obviously the federal BSA AML. With Sport Trade and what they are, both, you know, exchange and sports betting, what has it been like from talking to regulators and educating and getting to a place where there's an understanding of Sport Trade and how they function in the market?
Yeah, so Sport Trade is an online sports betting operator that offers exchange wagering. And in expanding and getting in additional markets, the education piece is, it's not really education, but it's more so awareness that there isn't that much of a difference between what the exchange piece is and then the regular standard online sports betting operator. We have the ability in New Jersey, where we do offer the exchange piece, for our patrons to set limit orders, which means they can name their own price. But outside of that, the only differentiating thing other than the exchange wagering as a sports betting operator for us is our prices are unbeatable, our services for bettors to be better bettors, and it doesn't look like a sports book, but really we're a sports book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in so many ways it functions, you know, to me exactly the same. I actually wish we had, you know, those same services in the Vegas area. Now, working with regulator to regulator, have, as you talk about awareness, what have those conversations been like? Because I don't think, whereas maybe we've seen this model in Europe before, right? There's a bit of a, it's a bit new, the term at least, if not, you know, the services within it to some of the regulators you're working with. So as you guys target new states and obviously roll out in new states, what has those conversations kind of been like at this point?
Honestly, at this point, the conversations is really explaining that one difference. Mm-hmm. And aside from that, there is not, based on the interpretation of the reg, any other difference. The conversations are ongoing. And I think that is something that is going to continue with really just that awareness piece of limit orders and setting your own prices. And for us, we're able to turn that on and off. In New Jersey, we offer it. In Colorado, we don't. As we continue, we may not offer it if that is something that the regulators, you know, if we are still in the conversations of talking about what that nuance is and what the differentiating factor is. But it's something that can be turned on and off. And we have launched in Colorado as an online sports book without the exchange wagering piece.
And so to be fair, the exchange wagering piece, more than a whole separate product or market or anything like that, it's just a feature within, you know, the sports betting market or the sports book that you're able to offer. And I guess that's where kind of that nuance and conversation comes in.
Yep, that's exactly it.
Perfect. I want to switch gears a little bit. You know, you obviously alluded to that you sit on the Greater Philadelphia ACAMS board. You know, as a fellow ACAMS board member, we really do see a lack of gaming specific, you know, AML education, you know, especially at the national level at this point and around the industry in general. So I wonder for you, as your team starts to grow, how do you address that with your team? Because, you know, the typical trainings we offer as organizations to our frontline operations and client services and people like those aren't the same level of training that our analysts and AML managers and BSA officers require. And so how are you tackling that right now?
There's a couple different pieces to that. So starting with from the ACAMS perspective. So being on the board, we had our planning meeting for 2024. And one of the big initiatives is to integrate more education for the casino online sports betting industries. And that is through putting events together. In terms of education, so there, I think there's two different pieces of it with the team and the company itself. There's AML compliance from a team education, so the AML compliance team, and then there's the AML firm-wide cross-team education. And starting with the AML compliance team education, it's really about continuous education on how to monitor and analyze patron behavior. And a lot of what we're doing is training and talking with the customer experience team that may have that direct frontline interactions with the customers. So in the education, I think what's important is not to do it in a silo of just AML teams and educating AML teams, but it's communicating to understand, discuss is what we're looking at, what may appear unusual to us. For example, it could actually be reasonable if you incorporate other communication that may have happened. Compliance, and it's important to understand, is the second line of defense. And then the first line of defense really is the CX team and the folks that have the direct interaction. So with the AML compliance team education, what I think is important is the training, allowing channels for cross-team communication and having ways where they both can interact with each other with information sharing internally. And then what I think is really important is also the firm-wide AML cross-training education. There's folks that are more direct customer-facing than we're going to be. And it's important for everyone to be educated on basics of what is anti-money laundering and what are red flags to look for. And I know some of the more recent publications do go into red flags at a high level, but it's important for in the communication to talk about specifics. And some of the examples I would give at the top of my head is what is source of funds? And those are the kind of level of conversations that an education that need to happen with why do we have to collect source of funds? In what situations would we collect source of funds? What are red flags that you should look for in conversations that you can then refer to the compliance team? And with those two levels of education, I think that would really help strengthen the whole AML compliance within the industry itself.
So there's a lot of points in there that you covered that I kind of want, I want to dig into some of them because there's some really good things that you said. First off, obviously, I'm really glad that as a board, you're pursuing that for, you know, your region, since there's, I mean, there's a heavy amount of gaming, obviously, you know, in the region that you sit on the board on. So that education level is necessary. But I really also like you talked about, you know, with training your team, working with operations to actually talk about what they see. And that's, I mean, that's probably the most important part because that gives you so much more insight into the customer. Now, I wonder if there's an external aspect also, right? I mean, obviously, you know, with FinCEN, there's constantly, you know, advisories and guidances and alerts coming out, things like those. And, you know, sometimes there are things that we or our teams don't have experience with. And that's where we look to these kind of external sessions, you know, whether it's an ACAMS or things like that. And, you know, as you start to put together these sessions with, you know, with ACAMS, with the greater Philadelphia area, how are you looking to address these external factors or how are you looking to educate your team on some of these external factors as they come in? And then really, and this is kind of an existential question, as an industry, how can we better cover, you know, education for AML at large? Because I think as an industry, we've struggled, you know, between the SBC North Americas and all these different conferences, you have AML sessions, but I don't think it's ingrained as much yet as, you know, in the culture, in the training as maybe as it could be.
Yeah, there's so many pieces to that. And I'm like, where do I start? With the educational organization, through organizations and within the industry, before diving into what can change, I think it's important to recognize the large effort that an attempt that has been made to spread education so far. And credit to AGA and referencing the 2022 AML Best Practice Guide, which covers the AML within casinos, online gaming industry, the NMLRA that just came out that addresses online gaming as a specific item. I see traction, I see effort and recognition that this is necessary and there is going to be more of it. I think for us being leaders in certain organizations where we do have the voice to be able to make a difference is key with ingraining this in our learning events and having topics that would be not just for financial institutions and credit unions, which a lot of ACAMS targets, let's be honest. So I think by being leaders in specific organizations, we have the power to help shape what is going out and the education piece of it. But to answer your question, I think by having more official publications and reiterating what we're seeing as what I've already started seeing, but really talking more about red flags and having there be more spaces of communication would help with this industry being more educated and having a way to share that information. But with that said, there needs to be a more formal information sharing process. So there's 314B, which is the bank-to-bank information sharing. And I've talked about this a lot in a lot of different ways. But when I first started at Sportrade, one of the first things I did, build a risk assessment and then register with FinCEN and then apply to 314B. You know, just natural course of action. I actually got a rejection letter from FinCEN that said, you're not eligible to participate in 314B. I was actually really surprised because why would I not be able to reach out to, I mean, in this case, it would be an institution. Why would I not be able to reach out to a financial institution to ask about a patron's activity? Because as we all know, in the industry as it is, you don't always, in the online gaming space at least, you don't see the patron. So you don't really know what's happening other than the data that you have in front of you. So I kind of go on a tangent, but that is something that I think contributes to education, but also information sharing. And there needs to be a more formalized operator casino information sharing program.
I mean, one, you probably saw me get chuckle a little, but also get a little fired up as soon as you brought up information sharing. To be fair, there is casino to casino information sharing, right? Casinos can't participate in 314B, and they have been for quite some time. But yeah, now you have these sports betting operations, and unfortunately, we haven't had FinCEN touch the language around what, you know, a betting or wagering institution or whatever you may want to call it is. I don't think they've even referenced the language since 2007, which was like when they gave that FAQ that said something along the lines of a sports book is only considered a licensed entity, you know, if they're tied to a brick and mortar location. Mm-hmm. And so we've had, you know, a few years have passed since then. We could say a couple minor things have happened, you know, just the overturning of PASPA, the rising of, you know, DFS, launching online sports betting in, you know, I don't know how many states at this point, the advent of skill-based games, all of which, you know, have functions that could be seen as having BSA AML risk. And we still, to your point, haven't really gotten an update from, you know, from FinCEN that allows us to have those information sharing mechanisms in place. And it's just, I would not want to be a CCO in your position right now dealing with that open risk, because that's got to be tough for you to be able to address, because it's one of our most powerful tools, especially for, you know, those highest risk patrons where you just, with everything in your own information ecosystem, you probably haven't gotten enough information to feel totally comfortable with the relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point, and to be fair, we've used 314B, but through our casino license holder. And there's jurisdictions where you don't need that. So in that instance, what do you do if you need more information about a patron itself? And kind of a tangent, but it's funny because sometimes when you're requesting information from the patron, I mean, there's been times where we and I'm certain other operators hear from the patron, we've never been asked that by any other operator. And I'm like, really? I find that very hard to believe that you've not been asked for certain information. But I digress. I think just having a more formal 314B program that could include online gaming operators would be something that would really help with the industry.
Yeah, and I think to kind of go back and tie it in a knot, that will open up such a flood of information that it will go back, probably help inform some of that training. Mm-hmm. Because now you're able to tie not just activity in a silo, but activity across a jurisdiction, right? Because presumably most of the, you know, I'm a sports bettor, right? I've got multiple sports betting apps on my phone, right? I jump to, you know, from app to see what the line is, to see if there's a better buy somewhere. And so what could look like suspicious activity on Sport Trade maybe isn't as suspicious because it was just a matter of finding a better line somewhere else. But we don't have those formal lines of communication right now. And so I think there is going to be a whole new slew of what is considered a red flag, what is considered suspicious, you know, once we have that information available to us. And that really is going to take our training, you know, to another level. And I thank you for calling out AGA, right? They're obviously, they've been on the forefront of trying to provide best practices. Yeah. And they've done a great job with updating that document, you know, on a regular basis since its inception. And I think conferences are starting to try to get to it. I think actually SBC North America is having it, you know, having an AML session on their main stage this year, which I think is the first time, you know, since I've started going to conferences that I have seen a BSA AML conversation on the main stage and, you know, not like tucked away a floor down in what's technically a garage or a boiler room with, you know, alarms and staff going off. So it'll be nice to actually see that, you know, present in front of the whole industry. But yeah, and now I'm going on a tangent, but no, but thank you for really pointing all of those things out in light of kind of that information sharing. You know, that's, and you called out the NMLRA, and that's something that's actually in the NMLRA, right? Is the lack of definition right now. So I don't know how much time you've had to dig in to the National Money Laundering Risk Assessment, but that's certainly, it's a little odd in that it's glossed over a little bit in that they say, well, some institutions may not be covered, but then they really throw it on, but they're technically probably money transmitters. So I don't know how much time you've had to dig into the NMLRA, but curious some of your first thoughts on there. And then there's some other topics I'd like to dig into.
Yeah. So I did get a chance to read it. And I thought there was a very small section on online gaming, but I call that a win because it's being recognized and it's being more apparent that this is something that needs more discussion and more camera time. And with the whole how they defined anything over a million or more would be considered in the BSA AML guidance, and then anything under would be considered money transmitter. That was interesting to read. But something that really did stick out to me was how it mentioned like non-compliance, and it talked about, well, there's SARs and CTRs are being filed, but the industry isn't being proactive. And to that, I think that wasn't really a fair statement to make as a general statement, because there's operators that have teams of folks that are dedicated to AML compliance. And I understand what was being said with that, but I think that it's not really true for everybody. And I can't speak to if it is or is not, but from Sport Trade and what we do here and other compliance leaders that we've spoken to, having strong controls around knowing your customers, monitoring activity, that's a core pillar. And where I think that there is improvement in being proactive would be what we just talked about, would be information sharing and having more discussion so that we can make sure that as the industry and calling out proactiveness, who are in the key roles that are responsible for the education of the AML teams and leading the AML teams? Do they have a BSA AML knowledge background, and do they understand how to apply it in the industry while all of it is being formalized and structured properly?
No, that's a really good point. And I agree with you in that there are so many in the industry like Sport Trade that proactive really doesn't seem like a fair term. I think there was two things in there. One, saying the industry is not proactive. And then two, saying there's, you know, organizations or platforms, sports betting platforms and things like that may not be aware of BSA AML obligations, mm-hmm. which, you know, at this point seems ludicrous with, you know, the AGA, I think, asking for guidance and reform going back as early as 2015, 3 years before PASPA was even overturned. But I wonder if there's something, there's a lack of visibility or lack of transparency that leads the Treasury to believe that, because they also, I think, took a shot at state-to-state regulation and how some regulators are, you know, more or less, you know, they said some regulators are weaker than others in some extent. And I think really compliance teams in gaming, we tend to view ourselves as proactive because there is a constant communication with the regulator, you know, with our state regulators. And there is a law enforcement aspect to that. I mean, the amount of fraud communications that have to go back and forth. I wonder if you can speak a little bit of that, because I feel like there is a very proactive aspect to what you're doing on that end.
Yeah, I agree. The one piece, though, to call out, which I thought was really interesting, was how they said that because there can be differences in jurisdiction by, or state by state regulatory guidances, there's room for jurisdictional arbitrage. And that was interesting because that's more the jurisdictional differences. A lot of them are really around like licensing and certification. And when it comes to BSA/AML, that's really should be at the entity level. I don't know if, you know, I fully did agree with that.
I was speaking to the proactiveness bit, right? Because within your jurisdictions, there is such proactive discussion with the regulator constantly. And there's a law enforcement, there's a fraud aspect with all of it, right? If you could speak a little to what you do there, because it seems like there's a lack of transparency or understanding from the federal or Treasury level that these kinds of conversations are going on.
Absolutely. I think to your point, the lack of transparency at a federal level may just be because of the lack of interaction with the federal level and the state and us. But from our end, and I'll speak with Sport Trade specifically, what we do for proactiveness is really applying the FinCEN guidance across the board and in all of our jurisdiction. Regardless of if there can be jurisdictional differences, we apply the most conservative approach. The state that has the most conservative view, we apply that with all of the jurisdictions. And as we grow and expand, that will be the approach because we don't want there to be room for one patron to think that one jurisdiction could be easier than another, because we want to make sure that we're standard across the board in knowing and addressing that there can be different views by different regulators. But we really have taken the most conservative approach with this across the board.
Okay. No, thank you for that. And there was a couple other things you said in there too that I found interesting. And I don't want to skip over, because you started going into the arbitrage and state by state differences. And you really spoke on that there may not be communication between that state and federal level. And having come from your background with financial institutions, you know, particularly, I think you would have worked with institutions that were regulated by the FDIC, right?
FDIC, OCC, FRB.
And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think where there were state regulators as well, in those industries, there could be a little bit more coordination between, you know, the examiner, the FDIC, you know, in some of these cases, and whoever the state regulator is. And I don't know how much we've seen that applied at the gaming industry level where, you know, the IRS is coming in for examinations and pulling in state regulators. Since you've kind of seen those models, you know, maybe you can speak to what that's like, whether pros and cons, whether you think it's a good thing, whether you don't think it's a good thing. I think given the NMLRA, there probably is something to be drawn from that.
Absolutely. So I'm not sitting here saying, hey, come audit me once a year. I remember that. It's not fun. But at the same time, there was a lot of value that came out through that. So currently, there's still the requirement, whether every operator does it or not, is to have an independent third-party audit come. And we went through our first BSA/AML audit, and that's a requirement. Now, from the financial institution perspective, when I was in that world, there was the annual regulatory exams where the FDIC, OCC, FRB, they would come in, they would go through their annual exam, and then there would be the state level exam. And what's interesting in this industry is there's not really either outside of the third independent third party auditor that comes in, which is, I would say, more so could be an extension of an internal audit resource as well.
Yeah, and I'll echo your prior statement, right? We're certainly not calling for annual audits at state and federal level. Right. But it does seem like in those industries there's been a bit more of a coordination. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there was that coordination, there would be a little bit more transparency and a little bit more view from the Treasury or FinCEN, really, in this case, that there is that proactiveness. And I would think that would come through. Or if maybe there isn't enough proactiveness at the end of the day, at least there's that coordination between the state and federal levels to know that with certainty and actually be able to judge the gaming industry based on a more holistic view.
I agree. And potentially a way around it is with the current independent audits that should be happening, maybe it's more communication or transparency in providing the information and the outcomes of those audits, which then would align with sharing that information to show this is what's actually happening within the industry itself.
And you mean for operators to be sharing the findings either at the state or at the federal level?
Potentially, because, you know, it would depend, you know, because then the next level would be, I'm not asking for all the state and federal level auditors to come in, but with what should be happening today, it's really trying to show that there is that proactiveness and that there is a comprehensive risk-based programs that should have strong controls in place and really go through and give that stamp of validation, so to say, of sure. What is happening within the operators.
No, I think, and obviously we're not giving, you know, guidance on what should happen or what FinCEN right. should do. But it's a mm-hmm. tough position to be in right now, because I think we're trying to figure out still mm-hmm. what's best. You know, we had Mohican Digital on for one of the prior podcasts. And, you know, one of the things LeBlanc said on there was, you know, it's still very much a nascent industry. You know, there is a level of what is the best way to approach this still that I think we're struggling with. I think from the view at the NMLRA, the Treasury is still struggling with, which I would imagine means FinCEN is one of their bureaus is struggling with, but we haven't really heard from FinCEN itself too much
right.
on the industry yet. And so it leaves this interesting gray area. That being said, you know, with the NMLRA coming out with obviously less than favorable view of the industry, yeah. with the recent non-prosecution agreement that, you know, we started this year with, you know, I do wonder if there's a bit of foreshadowing of what's to come for the industry. And so I wonder, you know, what you think of that, if that's discussions you've had with your executive team, or if just across the industry you've seen, you know, people starting to react to the combination of those things.
I think you're right. I think there is a foreshadow of what is coming. And to your point about FinCEN kind of being a little bit silent about this matter up until this point, with NMLRA coming out, I think it's a matter of time that FinCEN is going to follow. And there's a whole process of updating or adding to the guidances. So I do think that in the background, there is something that FinCEN is probably working on. And I mean, the biggest, easiest thing, for example, and I know I talk about red flags a lot, but I've seen like in the NMLRA and the AGA best practices, there's examples of red flags to look for in the industry. And I think something that could be beneficial is Appendix F in the BSA AML FinCEN guidance, which is red flags for financial institutions, really just adding some more to that or adding another appendix that would be for our industry. But to your question, I think it's a foreshadow. I think that there's more coming and we're really just at the tip of the iceberg of the education and the information that will be coming out, because more people are being vocal and more people are interested and are really getting to the right people to hear them out for, hey, give us more guidance, give us more information.
Yeah. And I hope, I mean, again, it seems like we're both on the same page that this might be foreshadowing. I hope there's more communication from FinCEN as we get to wherever this may go, because it's been almost deafening silence at this point. And to be fair, you've got a new FinCEN director in Andrea Gacky, who's been dealing with, you know, especially coming from an OFAC background and her heavy sanctions background between Ukraine and, you know, the conflict in the Middle East right now. I'm sure they've more than had their hands full. And so there's really been no public comment from FinCEN too much on the gaming industry. But it does make me wonder, because the NMLRA, because that non-prosecution agreement, if there is something going in the background. Now, one thing that I've started looking into recently, and I'd be curious your thoughts on this, is, you know, the AGA and the industry have asked for guidance for a long time. And I think, to me, whether my opinion is, you know, correct or terribly wrong, it's become clear that this isn't really a guidance discussion, and it's more of a, you know, rulemaking discussion. Mm-hmm. There would have to be, you know, proposed rulemaking for this definition to be changed for online operators, for, you know, sports betting without a direct license attachment to a casino to be included in this definition, and whatever else may fall under that wagering activity definition. And if that's the case, you know, the Treasury could be fair in calling us out for not being proactive if maybe we don't change our approach. Now, looking at the registry, there is an option to do what's called a petition for rulemaking. And so theoretically, the industry at large, you know, whether it's the AGA or other trade associations or other members of the industry, could do a petition for rulemaking to FinCEN to extend that. And I think that really changes the conversation and puts the onus on FinCEN. That's also a dangerous approach, right? Asking for regulation and, you know, asking for regulation on a very specific topic. Just curious your thoughts on that. If that's something you've, you know, being such a participant in the industry, I feel like even though sport trade, it's not like a FanDuel in, you know, share market size or something like that. But I've seen your guys' voices everywhere. I've obviously seen your CEO speak a number of times, and you know, he's got a great mind, and it seems like you guys do have some influence in the industry. So just curious your thoughts on where the industry could maybe go there.
I actually really love that thought, and we all should absolutely do it. Like right here, there's two leaders that are within the industry, and then we have on our teams, we have so many leaders as well. Proposed rulemaking, to your point, is absolutely what needs to happen. There's a whole process that goes with it, which is iterative. It requires multiple discussions and it can be drawn out. But to your point about, you know, it could be dangerous and we want to tread lightly, I think a way to approach that would be we should get the leaders within the industry and actually draft what we would want the rules to be to then propose as the initial draft. And then I think that would have a starting point of now let's discuss. And then that way we can actually have more of a say in guiding what the outcome could be and be more active in that conversation. So I really like that. And I think if nothing else from this podcast and all the listeners and viewers, that should be the message that we should really move forward with that. I know from ACAM's national perspective, they are working on setting up a task force that is targeted more for the online sports betting space itself. That's more so around the education of it, but that could AGA, ACAMS, like all of those could be the platforms and the thought leaders behind this proposed rulemaking and really putting together something that can help us, because we're in the industry and we would be the ones that are directly impacted by this.
Well, that settles it. We're calling out ACAMS, we're calling out the AGA.
We're doing it all together. We're all one team. We're doing it together.
You know, to your point, though, it is really this long iterative process. And I think maybe that's why the industry has leaned towards guidance for so long in their calls, because it's, you know, it's a lot easier to issue guidance than it is to, you know, issue rulemaking. But that hasn't yielded anything up to this point. And if it's going to have to be rulemaking, better get started sooner than later, because otherwise, you know, how many more years down the line we're going to be 10 years post PASPA and, you know, without regulatory changes, leaving, I mean, a huge gap in, you know, the American financial system in terms of AML risk if this isn't addressed. So
Let's do it.
I think that's the route we got to go.
I think so too.
Well, Arpita, thank you for letting me get on my soapbox about that. And really, thank you so much for coming on. It's been really interesting talking to you. Obviously, we talk all the time, but I loved having you as a guest on here, being able to pick your brain. If there's nothing else, you know, you want to talk about or anything you want to get into, just thank you again for coming on today. It's been a great conversation.
Sean, thank you for having me on. I, as always, really enjoy our conversations, and it was an honor coming on here and being able to chat about all of this.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Take care.
Thanks again for joining us today on Connectify Conversations. You can support our show even more by leaving us a rating wherever you download your podcast and by sharing Connectify Conversations with gaming industry leaders like yourself. Visit Connectify.com to learn more. That's KINECTIFY.com. Until our next conversation, always remember to minimize risk and maximize your efficiency.